WBUR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Tonight, Joe Biden will officially accept the Democratic nomination for president, bringing to close the first ever virtual Democratic National Convention. Last night, his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, accepted a historic nomination of her own. She talked about Black women who have shaped history and about her own mother.
I keep thinking about that 25-year-old Indian woman, all of 5 feet tall, who gave birth to me at Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, California. On that day, she probably could have never imagined that I would be standing before you now and speaking these words. I accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States of America.
We are joined now by Yvette Simpson, Democratic strategist and chief executive of Democracy for America. Hi, Yvette.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
Doing well. So an historic moment there that we just heard part of, the first Black woman ever accepting the nomination to a major party's ticket to be vice president. What did it mean to you, first of all?
Everything. It meant everything. I mean, I was so moved. I was literally, I was on the set while we were covering it, and I had chills. I thought about all of the young Black women, Black girls, white women, white girls who are going to see this as, for them, I think the first time they've been able to see themselves in an office this high, particularly Black and brown girls. And I could not help but be proud of, one, the way that she presented herself, the way she introduced herself. She looked very presidential. She seemed very sure. She seemed very comfortable. It was a historic moment. And anyone who watched that moment and didn't feel deeply emotional, I mean, I can't imagine.
Well, we did hear her tell some of her personal story in a way that she really didn't during her presidential campaign. She talked about having an Indian mother and a Jamaican-born father. Do you think that that personal story will resonate with voters?
I think that's right. I mean, when you think about particularly this moment in history and where we are in our country, you know, the idea that when we're talking about immigration, we're talking about race relations, you know, her story is the story that we should be talking about. And I think it's one that connects with a lot of people. The idea that you could work your way, you know, her parents coming here, you could work your way as the daughter of immigrants, as a Black woman in America, as an Indian woman in America, and get to this place. I mean, it means a lot. And I hope that resonates with people. I think it does.
We did hear from President Obama, who spoke before Kamala Harris last night, and said that President Trump and Republicans, Obama said this, can only win if people don't vote, either because they can't vote or because they've lost hope. Listen.
Do not let them take away your power. Do not let them take away your democracy. Make a plan right now for how you are going to get involved and vote. Do it as early as you can and tell your family and friends how they can vote too. Do what Americans have done for over two centuries when faced with even tougher times than this. All those quiet heroes who found the courage to keep marching, keep pushing in the face of hardship and injustice.
Yvette, what did you make of what President Obama said last night? Because in addition to saying that, he really did go after President Trump in a way that he hasn't so far.
You know, I think a theme of the convention, and rightly so, is that people need to vote, that this is an important election. There are some folks who are saying, vote like your life depends on it. I think Michelle Obama might have said that on the very first day. And he's right. You know, with attacks on the post office, folks knowing that voter suppression is going to be an issue, particularly in key battleground states, very important. I love that he, you know, he was ushering John Lewis into the room, I think, when he talked about our past and the folks who have sacrificed so much for us to have this moment. And I think what Democrats know is that if people don't show up, we lose. And if people show up overwhelmingly, we will win. And that really is the difference. And I'm glad that they are harping on that. And I know that that gets Donald Trump really upset, because I think his strategy is fewer people vote, I win. More people vote, I lose.
He was clearly watching Obama speak. He responded, President Trump did it, on Twitter in all caps. Do you think that this strategy by Trump to live tweet the events and to hold events at the same time as the DNC, will that work?
You know, it depends on who he's talking to. And I think that's the big question, Jeremy, that we'll talk about both at the end of this convention and at the end of the RNC. Who are these two parties talking to? Donald Trump is talking to his base. They don't like Barack Obama. He staked his claim on being, you know, not Barack Obama. And so he's really saying, look, you know, I am the guy you should be paying attention to. This guy is the reason I'm here. I think he said at one point, you know, Barack Obama had done his job. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be president. He's throwing red meat to his base. But I think for middle America, if he's trying to make a play for independents or reasonable Republicans, as I call them, I don't think this works.
Well, so who are the Democrats talking to?
That depends on who he's trying to talk to. You know, that is a question. And that's been kind of a point of contention for me. You know, the number of Republicans that have shared the space, the lack of progressive voices at the table makes me believe that the Democratic National Convention is as much about recruiting Republicans as it is about recruiting independents and Democrats. And the question is, are we doing all those things really well? And so we'll ask ourselves at the end of the 4 days, were people's minds changed based on these 4 days? Did we really get the people that we need to get? And that'll be the essential question, I think, at the end of the day. I'm not sure.
That is Yvette Simpson, Democratic strategist and chief executive of Democracy for America. And of course, Joe Biden will speak tonight at the convention. Yvette, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Let's go to Northern California now, where the scope of several big wildfires is growing. It's estimated that nearly 11,000 lightning strikes triggered the fires earlier this week, and it's a public safety scramble as fire crews navigate the challenges of a scorching heat wave and COVID-19. Joining us now is Kate Wolf, a reporter with KQED in San Francisco. And Kate, give us a sense of where these fires are burning. Are they largely on country roads or in urban centers?
So, Tanya, there are three big complexes of fires happening around the Bay Area here. There's a huge, massive fire in the North Bay, and that's in Napa and Solano counties. There's a large rural fire happening in Santa Clara County, and then there's a more urban fire happening in the South Bay in Santa Cruz and San Mateo counties.
You mentioned Napa. How close are these new fires to the other places that experienced the big fires there in recent years?
Well, they're fairly close. There's a lot of overlap. There are a lot of people who have had to evacuate from these areas time and time again over the past couple of years. They are lower down than the deadly campfire that happened in Paradise. But these are still, you know, wildfire-plagued areas, and continually so.
It has been extremely hot across the state all week, which has triggered some rolling blackouts. How is this impacting communication efforts?
Things have moved so quickly that we are not actually currently dealing with those blackouts as much. People have been good about conserving energy so as to not overwhelm the state's electrical grid. But we will find out more about how communication was or wasn't hampered in the next few days and in the coming weeks.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm just thinking about how COVID-19 has impacted so much, especially the way that firefighters fight fires and the way that people receive notification where they can go if they have to flee their homes. How are officials reaching out to the most vulnerable, including the homeless, about these fires?
That's a great point. And in fact, we're seeing impacts where places that would normally be shelters are not being shelters because they're at capacity. They're sending people to hotel rooms, or they're just simply sending people away. We don't know yet how officials have been contacting people like homeless folks, but we do know that there are a lot of vulnerable people who are scrambling for a place to stay, either because they're old and they're worried about being exposed to the virus in a communal shelter, or because there's just not enough room for them in communal spaces.
Yeah. We heard the governor this week talk about many of the challenges. But what assurances are you hearing that there is enough manpower and equipment and money to fight these fires?
you know, we really aren't getting assurances. We know CAL FIRE is stretched to a breaking point with these fires. We have requested very early on, CAL FIRE requested aid from other states. We've seen an influx of help from Southern California. So, you know, we're really hoping for more aid and we're waiting to see that aid come through.
You're in the San Francisco Bay Area, Kate, and typically when there are wildfires of this size, you can experience smoke and haze hundreds of miles away. What is it like where you are?
You know, it's starting to get really smoky here, and it seems like it's only going to get smokier, to be honest. You can smell the smoke in the air. You can see the haze. The light is more orange. It's definitely reminiscent of Septembers, Octobers, and Novembers of years past when it's been really bad and the air quality has been unhealthy. It seems like it might reach that level here in maybe today, maybe in the coming days.
That's Kate Wolfe. She is a reporter with KQED in San Francisco. Kate, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
Long before COVID-19 changed so much of how we interact with each other, Dr. Vivek Murthy, the former U.S. Surgeon General under President Obama, had been on a mission to make us think of loneliness as a public health issue. A few years ago, he framed the condition of loneliness, which can reduce life expectancy, as an epidemic in the United States. Now, with so many of us unable to connect with friends and loved ones in person, how can we mitigate loneliness and its consequences? Dr. Vivek Murthy joins us now to help answer this. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Tanya. It's great to be with you.
Yes, doctor. So you declared some years ago loneliness as an epidemic. And when you frame it this way, it's not just a fleeting feeling of feeling disconnected, but as a public health crisis. Can you explain more of what you mean?
Despite my own experiences, my personal experiences with loneliness, despite having seen so much of it in the healthcare setting, what I had not fully understood was that loneliness is associated with an increased risk of heart disease, of premature death, of dementia, depression, anxiety, sleep disturbances, and the list goes on. And I found that when I talked about loneliness as a public health concern, that it struck people as unusual. They would often say, isn't the job of a surgeon general to talk about tobacco or to talk about obesity or other traditional topics? And my response was always that when you understand just how profound the health impacts of loneliness are, when you understand, in fact, the opposite as well, which is how profound the health benefits of social connection are, then it's hard not to consider loneliness and social connection an important public health concern.
I want to ask you, in the context of this moment that we're in, many people are calling it the new normal. I'm just wondering from you, doctor, are we normalizing these new ways that we're isolated in ways that could impact us health-wise? What are the negative health impacts of sustained loneliness or social distance in the context of the moment that we're in right now? Because we're experiencing it in ways that we have never had before. I mean, typically we've been able to at least have human connection via work or via school, those types of things.
You know, I think if we do nothing differently in our lives, if we allow this pandemic to just further separate us more and more, my worry is that we will bring upon ourselves what I think of as a social recession marked by growing loneliness and a sense of disconnection from others. But I think that we can, in fact, make a very different choice. We can choose the path not of social recession, but of social revival, and can use this moment to ask ourselves where we want people to fall in our priority lists. We can use this as a chance to double down on our relationships and our commitment to the people we really care about. And the reason this matters so much is because for many of us, and I would put myself right at the top of the list, there has been a gap between our stated priorities and our lived priorities. If you have asked me at any point over the last 20, 30 years, Vivek, what are your priorities in life? I would inevitably tell you that it was people, that it was my mother, my father, my sister, and then later years, it was my wife and my kids. But if I ask myself, how was I actually living my life? What priorities were reflected in how I was spending my time, attention, and energy? The truth was, work was my real priority.
Oh, and doctor, singing my song, okay? Yes. I think so many of us have that where, I mean, our stated priorities versus what we live every day really come into focus, for sure.
That's right. And this is, you know, it's not a unique struggle. It's the struggle of the modern world. It's one that we live in a world that has told us in so many ways that we should achieve more, that we should strive to make impact, that we should build our careers. And none of those things are wrong. The question is, where does that fall relative to our priorities around people?
Well, your book, Together, The Healing Power of Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World, came out in the midst of all of this, in the midst of the pandemic and quarantine orders. And in it, you actually outline 4 strategies for people to overcome this crisis. And they're pretty prescriptive. Can you lay them out for us?
There's been a gap in my own life. And this pandemic and the whole journey over the last few years of exploring this topic of social connection and loneliness has made me realize there is that gap. And so how do we close that gap? Well, we don't have to just wait until after the pandemic is over, until we can see people in person to start closing that gap. We can actually start strengthening our connections right now. And there are a few simple ways I lay out in the book, a few steps among others that we can take to do this. So one of them is to make it a point to spend at least 15 minutes a day with people we care about. That could be on the phone. It could be a short video conference call. It could be writing to someone that we care about just to say, hey, I'm thinking of you and I want to know how you're doing. The second thing we can do is we can make it a point to make the time we do spend with people count. We can focus on the quality of time. And we can do that by eliminating distraction. Now, distraction abounds because we have phones in our pockets nearly at all times. It's so easy to pull them out and to check our email or social media or to check the news or the scores on last night's game when we're talking to other people. And we do this because we think we can multitask. The science is very clear that we don't actually multitask. We rapidly task switch in our brain. What that means is that when I'm looking at my inbox, I'm actually not fully hearing what someone else is saying. Even if I recall the words, I may have missed the nuance, the tone of their voice, the pause, which may have signaled that they were a little uncomfortable and wanted to talk more about that topic. And so quality time really matters. And if you want to know how to stretch time, the way you stretch time is with your focus, by concentrating on someone else. And one last one, a couple last things I just mentioned is that you can do to strengthen connections is, third, you can look for opportunities to serve. So whether you are helping a neighbor who may be struggling to get groceries during this pandemic crisis, whether you're having food delivered to a friend, whether you're offering to virtually babysit for 10 minutes for a friend who might be struggling to homeschool their children and also telework, there are many ways to serve during a time when so many of us are in need.
There's also a fourth one, and that's to embrace solitude. And this seems to be the opposite of building connection. What do you mean by this?
Solitude does not have to look the same in everyone's life. Solitude can just be, and it doesn't also have to take a lot of time. It's not necessarily a 7-day vacation or a 7-day retreat away from your family. Solitude can be a few minutes that we spend sitting on our front porch feeling the breeze against our face. Can be time with a piece of music that deeply inspires us. However we find our solitude, and when we approach other people from a place of being more centered and more grounded, you know what happens? We're more able to listen as opposed to constantly focusing on trying to be who they want us to be in conversation. And that enriches our connection.
Switching gears just slightly, I mentioned that you joined Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden in the call for wearing masks, and you were one of the top healthcare advisors to the Biden campaign. What would you like to see centered as we continue to live the realities of this pandemic? You've actually said that you don't believe that even with advancements in vaccines, that we won't return to any place of normalcy until 2022.
Yes, I think it's going to take a while for things to get back to where they were pre-pandemic. And even if we do have a vaccine, what has worried me is seeing public polls that show, as of late July, early August, that a third of people are saying that if a vaccine was available today, they wouldn't take it. And because people have concerns, you know, at baseline, there's a very small segment of the population that has general concerns about vaccines. But more broadly, with COVID-19, there are people who are wondering, is this going to be taken through a safe approval process? Is it going to be rushed through? Will there be politics involved in approving this vaccine? And we absolutely hope that won't be the case. In fact, it should be the case that science is what's guiding, like, our ability to approve this vaccine, and we have to make sure it is both effective and safe. Both are really critical.
There's so much to consider there. But ultimately, when we think about building practices to stay connected in the long haul, as we go through all of these changes, what's your takeaway advice?
This whole subject, Tanya, of social connection and loneliness is really about the quest to build a people-centered world that is powered by love. And if I look at everything that I have learned over the years about medicine and public health, it has become clear to me that there are few things more powerful than the power of love to help us heal, to help us rebuild and to renew. And so that, to me, is at the heart of what this is all about. But I also think that this is how we are built as human beings. And if we can use this pandemic as an opportunity to take stock of our lives and to recommit to building the kind of people-centered life, then I think there are good things in store for us. It is those connections, our human connections, that are the foundation on which we build everything else.
That's Dr. Vivek Murthy, former U.S. Surgeon General under the Obama administration, advisor to presidential nominee Joe Biden, and author of Together, The Healing Power of Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. Dr. Murthy, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Tanya. So nice to be with you.
Today, former White House advisor Steve Bannon was arrested and charged with defrauding hundreds of thousands of people who'd given money to his online campaign to build a border wall. Bannon is set to appear before a judge in the Southern District of New York. For more, we're joined by NPR justice correspondent Ryan Lucas. And Ryan, Bannon, people remember, was also part of the president's 2016 campaign. What are authorities saying he and others did with this online crowdfunding campaign called We Build the Wall?
Well, We Build the Wall was, as you said, it was an online fundraising campaign, and it raised about $25 million. And as part of that campaign, they promised that all of the money that donors gave to the campaign would go directly to helping build a wall on the southern border with Mexico. They repeatedly said this in solicitations. They repeatedly said that no salaries would be paid, not a penny. Prosecutors say that ultimately that was not true. Steve Bannon, as well as a man by the name of Brian Colfage and two other defendants, they say devised a scheme to basically secretly siphon off money to pay themselves. Colfage, prosecutors say, received around $350,000, money that he used to pay for home renovations, payments on a boat, a luxury SUV, a golf cart. The other three, that includes Bannon, each also received hundreds of thousands of dollars in funds from donors that were basically siphoned off. All four defendants are facing one count each of conspiracy to commit wire fraud and conspiracy to commit money laundering.
Hmm. Have Bannon or his attorneys responded to these allegations?
There hasn't been any comment yet from Bannon or his attorney. At this point, I will say, however, that as you mentioned in the beginning here, is that he is expected to be in federal court in Manhattan later today. And so we may hear from him there.
We did hear from President Trump, who was asked for his reaction to the arrest and said he feels very badly, but knows nothing about the fundraising organization involved. Bannon is at least the sixth member of the 2016 Trump campaign to face federal charges after former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman, Rick Gates, Michael Cohen, Roger Stone. What are the political implications here?
Well, this just happened earlier this morning, and so I think it's difficult to say what the political implications going forward over the course of the next couple months are going to be. But certainly, I would not be surprised to see Democrats mention this list of people that you just mentioned who were close advisors to the president, all of whom are facing or have faced or been convicted on federal charges. And it's something that, you know, Democrats may point out that the company you keep says a lot about who you are. So it may be something that we see in the campaign going forward. But in terms of short-term political implications in the immediate term, we haven't seen anything yet.
Meanwhile, for Steve Bannon, what is next and what kind of penalty would he face if convicted?
Well, money laundering and fraud charges are big crimes in the federal book. Both carry up to 20 years in prison. Ultimately, if he's convicted, he's unlikely to face that because of a range of factors. But these are serious, serious crimes. And so, you know, he's going to we will see whether he'll fight them. But certainly these are serious allegations that he's facing, and the potential repercussions in time in jail could be significant.
That is NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas on the breaking news today that Steve Bannon, the former White House advisor, has been arrested. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny is reportedly unconscious in a hospital today, and there are concerns that he was poisoned. He got sick on a flight, and his plane had to make an emergency landing in the Russian city of Omsk. Joining us now is the BBC's Sergei Goryashko in Moscow. Sergei, what is known about what happened to Navalny?
Well, what we know for now is that Navalny is in stable but grave condition. He is still in a coma. He's held in the hospital in the city of Omsk. It's the middle of Siberia. And Navalny's wife and his supporters came already from Moscow to Omsk. But the doctors there don't let them to go inside and to see what happens with Navalny and how is he. Also, we know that Navalny's supporters, Navalny's team is going to transfer him in hospital in Europe. Probably that will be Hanover in Germany to treat him there, because they don't believe Russian doctors and they believe more in medicine like abroad. But now his condition is critical and he's not ready to be transported, which is why he's still there in Omsk.
Now, he is 44 years old. He is a staunch critic of President Putin. Tell us more about who he is.
Well, for the last 10 years, approximately, Navalny has been the main opposition figure in Russia. He's the vocal critic of Putin. He's his thorn in the back, if I can say so. And he started as an opposition blogger, writing about corruption cases among officials or businessmen somehow connected, linked with the government. Thereafter, he held a very successful campaign during the elections in 2011, and this campaign against the United Russia Party, that's the main ruling party in this country, made this party almost lose the elections in the State Duma, that's the parliament. Navalny raised like lots of people to come on the streets. There were mass rallies, like hundreds of thousands of people in Moscow, in St. Petersburg and other cities, who were protesting against United Russia, the party which Navalny libels as a party of crooks and thieves. After that, he tried to run for mayor of Moscow. And Navalny even tried to participate into the presidential election in 2018. But he was barred from running because he was convicted in embezzlement. He denies any wrongdoing. He thinks that this criminal case was political. He has a very successful anti-corruption foundation, which does big and very good investigations on different politicians and Putin's friends. And he even made a very successful investigation on Dmitry Medvedev, that's been ex-president of Russia and prime minister. After that investigation, specifically in 2017, there were also mass rallies in Moscow. So there are lots of reasons for Kremlin not to love Navalny, as you can see.
Well, and if indeed he was poisoned, this would not be the first Putin critic to be targeted. There's a long list.
Not at all. But what many experts here in Russia say, and what I should agree with, that such thing as Navalny's poisoning by either security services, either some Putin's hitman, could only happen with Putin's approval. And now there is no reason for Putin to try to put Navalny in hospital or even to kill him, because there are no very prominent political campaigns running, no very big elections in Russia. Actually, what Navalny was doing in Siberia, he was holding small campaigns for local elections in some Siberian cities where his supporters are running for some places in city parliaments or regional parliaments, which is why we're still very puzzled about who and why would want Navalny to be poisoned. And Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has already told that Kremlin wishes Navalny a speedy recovery, and they also told that they would help if Navalny's family would want him to be treated abroad.
That is the BBC's Sergei Goryashko joining us from Moscow. Sergei, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me.
Well, each week we are looking at different House races across the country as part of our Here and Now District Profile series. Today, it's the 21st Congressional District in Texas, where incumbent Republican Congressman Chip Roy faces a challenge from former Texas State Senator Wendy Davis. David Martin Davies hosts Texas Matters and The Source on Texas Public Radio. He's in San Antonio. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, and I remember 2 years ago when Chip Roy first won this seat, I was in the district and we did a story about this very seat. Tell us a little bit about this district, because you're in San Antonio and it stretches all the way up to Austin, right?
This is a district that covers an area known as the Texas Hill Country, and it stretches south to San Antonio, then up north to Austin, and sweeps over left to cover this area that Johnson City, where LBJ hailed from, Fredericksburg, Kerrville. And this is a area traditionally seen as very Republican.
But Chip Roy just barely won it last time.
He squeaked by with about 50%, 50.3% of the vote. And that was kind of a stunner. There was a Libertarian in the race that took away 2% of vote that may have gone to Chip Roy. But still, it looked teed up this district as seemed like something that it could flip blue.
Well, Representative Roy was asked on CNN last month about the federal response to the pandemic. He said the country needed to be able to work through viruses without crippling the economy. Here he is.
How many people are dying from depression, opioid abuse, lack of cancer screenings? One of my best friends just went in and got a stage 3 breast cancer diagnosis. She hasn't been getting her screenings. Why? Because we've been shutting down elective procedures, shutting down people's access to health care. This is what we need to do. Explain the truth and not scare them.
Tell us a little bit about Congressman Roy's record and how closely aligned he is with President Trump.
Congressman Roy is part of the Freedom Caucus, a very conservative group of legislators in the House. He has voted against the COVID response packages. You know, he's concerned about what this would do to the national deficit. And he is basically supports President Trump 100%.
Mm-hmm. And he's running this time against Wendy Davis, who our listeners may remember, a Democrat, a former Texas state senator. She made a lot of headlines for her filibuster in 2013 against an anti-abortion law. Here is a recent campaign video from her.
I'm running for Congress because people's voices are still being silenced. I'm running for our children and grandchildren so they can live and love and fight for change themselves.
Now, in that video, we see her tying pink sneakers on a young girl's feet. We remember Davis's pink sneakers during the filibuster. Tell us about her campaign.
Wendy Davis was a Texas state senator from 2009 to 2015 in Fort Worth. She ran for governor of Texas in 2014. She lost to the now governor, Greg Abbott, when she got 38% of the vote. You know, she didn't do well in that race, but she did establish herself as someone who would campaign on these particular issues, pro-reproductive rights, gun control type issues, and support for LGBTQ rights. But she does have a history, a personal history of voting in Republican primaries and donating to Republican candidates, including George W. Bush when he ran for president. Hmm.
And is she new to this district? Because you said she was in Fort Worth before.
Well, you could say that both of these candidates are new to the district. This is Chip Roy's first defense of this congressional seat. Before then, you know, he really wasn't from here. So if there's an allegation that one candidate is a carpetbagger, then that would apply to both of them.
Interesting. Is a lot of outside money coming into this race?
Oh, yeah, there's quite a bit of outside money coming into the race. This is but Wendy Davis is getting most of it. She's been able to raise like $4.5 million so far to about $2.6 million that Chip Roy's been able to raise. Both of them are getting outside money and are campaigning, you know, at this as a national race. That's the Chip Roy's side of the race is trying to make an issue of that Wendy Davis is an outsider, getting outside money, trying to take over this district.
Are there any polls yet?
Well, the Cook Political Report has this as a toss-up. They had moved it from lean Republican to toss-up. It's basically neck and neck.
Well, we will be watching that race and many others. David Martin Davies, host of Texas Matters and The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jay.
We're seeing just how challenging it is right now to reopen schools during this pandemic and how that is affecting sports. The University of North Carolina has temporarily suspended all athletic activity because of the spread of COVID-19 on the Chapel Hill campus. UNC had already moved all of its classes online just a week after opening school to in-person classes. Mike Pesca is sports analyst for Here and Now, and he also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, UNC is just one school, but every college is really struggling with this right now. And there doesn't really seem to be any consensus about what to do about college sports, especially the big moneymaker, football. What are you seeing?
Right. So no consensus is a key point because college sports, there is an NCAA, but when it comes to big time football, it sort of stands apart from the NCAA because the Power Five conferences, these are the five biggest conferences that usually field the national championship. They make their own money, so they don't need the NCAA. Mm-hmm. So right now the landscape looks like this. Of those five conferences, and there are 130 teams playing at the highest levels. So we're just talking about the teams at the five conferences. Two of the huge conferences canceled everything. Now, three of the remaining conferences, and UNC is in one of them, they say they're going to play. But there is no commissioner of those other conferences. And in fact, every school has its own say. So it's wonderful if other teams in the ACC say, we're going ahead to play, but there is an outbreak on the campus of UNC. 2 days ago, North Carolina defined college football as, well, we'll do the football part and forget the college part. The college kids and maybe our football players can learn remotely. We'll have practice. But then the outbreak got so severe, they said, we'll at least be temporarily suspending our play. So I don't know what it means. And if they think they know what it means, they're fooling themselves. They'll have to see the progression of the virus, and that's going to come into play, and that's going to perhaps abut their best intentions.
So, Mike, just to get clarification, too, from you about playing, not playing, aren't there other schools saying that they're going to play home football games with fans actually in the stands?
They're trying to, you know, this is the plan. And there have been sporting events with some fans in the stands all spread out. You would think, especially in an outdoor stadium, it shouldn't be impossible. Is it advisable? I don't know. And I don't know if it'll be possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the NFL. So that season is supposed to start in less than a month. Has the league or any of the teams made any decisions about whether fans can come to those games?
They're going ahead with the games, or they're trying to. The owner of the Cowboys has said, we'd like to have fans at the games. Right now, different states have different decrees, so it seems quite unlikely in places like New York. Again, this is just whatever the announced plans are here in August when games are to kick off in September. I wouldn't put much credence in what the intentions are of people weeks before we see what's actually going on.
So true, yes. Let's talk a little bit about the games that we can watch right now. There's plenty of stuff to watch on TV. The playoffs are underway in the NHL and the NBA. What's jumping out to you about these games?
Well, sports-wise, those two leagues are doing great. Let's add the WNBA in there. No outbreaks, maybe a model for how to do this and what a bubble means. Also, interestingly, in the NBA, because all the teams are playing in the same facility, there really is no home court advantage in the playoffs, and we've seen the two top seeds in each conference lose their first game. One of them was the LA Lakers, which lost to an energized Portland Trailblazer team. But the Lakers made news beyond the court, not just by losing, but all of the team wore red hats that looked like MAGA hats from afar. But instead of Make America Great Again, the great again was crossed out. And the message was, Make America Arrest the Cops Who Killed Breonna Taylor. And that's what LeBron James wanted to talk about. And that's what the team in this unified message, they got it trending on Google. And so it does seem like not only are they committed to have a message, their message is well thought out. And they're making a real impact as far as what Americans know and are learning about some of these social justice issues.
I want to ask you about something else. So the Cincinnati Reds have suspended broadcaster Tom Brenneman because of an anti-gay slur he made on the air yesterday. He apologized before he was actually pulled off the air. But what is the team saying about this?
Yeah, it was a very strange series of events where he didn't know a mic was on and he said, you know, the most offensive anti-gay slur in who knows who he was talking to, an offhanded remark. And then in the second game of doubleheader, he came back and apologized. During his apology, a player hit a home run, which he announced, you know, in a muted form, but that was surreal. And as to your question, the Reds have said that they're devastated by the, quote, horrific homophobic remark made this evening by broadcaster Tom Brennan, and they say they embrace a zero tolerance policy for bias or discrimination. We're addressing our broadcasting team in the coming days.
A lot here. Thank you so much, Mike. That's Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst, and he hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production. Thank you. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson. In the UK, arena shows are back, sort of. Sam Fender just played for 2,500 socially distanced fans.
There was so much pent-up frustration from lockdown that people seem to be singing a hell of a lot louder than they probably would have been if it was last year.
That's next time on Here and Now.